AT&T Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. This is Jason Q, Citizen and Friends, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And indeed, you really want to tell us what you really think, and tell us what you think of Nicola Charles, who was just on filling in for Mike Ryan. Wasn't that a surprise for everyone that the former star of Neighbours, who has well and truly gone way past the establishment soap opera world and has become the White Rabbit and a big, huge following, and speaking about all the topics that you're not allowed to speak to, it's really cool, isn't it, when somebody from the other side of the fence comes over this way and starts talking truth. Well, she's been doing it for a long time now, but it's interesting how we're all getting together and putting out this great big agenda. We've got a massive show again today with former Queensland Premier Campbell Newman, who will be joining me shortly. And then in the second hour, English finance expert Tim Price will be joining me. And you can even download his free book, The War on Cash, from his website. We'll have breaking news and analysis with Jeremy Beck and Darren Denslow. Now, the new New South Wales COVID statistics are out again every Thursday. You can have a quick look at those right now. There were 609 hospitalizations to COVID in New South Wales in the past week, dated up to the 26th of November, resulting in 42 ICU stays and 25 deaths. Out of those 25 deaths to COVID in New South Wales, 24 of them were vaccinated. Ain't that a surprise? Only one person was counted as having had no dose. It gets worse, of course, for the vaccine agenda, because 12 of the 25 deaths involved people who'd had four or more doses, six had had three doses, and five had had two doses. So how is it that if you had two doses, you're less likely to die than if you had three, and if you had three doses, you're half as likely to die if you had four or more? Now, maybe we're saying, oh, that's because only the older people and the weaker people are taking the vaccines. Well, if you look at the age groups in deaths here, 24 of 25 of the people were aged 60 plus, meaning that pretty much everyone had reached retirement age or older. Five people in the 60-plus age group, six people in the 70-plus, nine in the 80-plus, and four in the 90-plus. There was one death in somebody aged 20 to 29, the first death under the age of 50 in months here in New South Wales. Truly extraordinary numbers. Now, more than 90% of COVID deaths occurring are amongst adults over the age of 65, according to the CDC in the United States. Very interesting data coming out there in a report on MSN, of all places. They're even reporting this. It's the first time they said senior citizens have made up more than 9 out of 10 deaths since the pandemic began, and a drastic increase from the roughly 58% of deaths they made up in the summer of 2021, which would be the period June to August in the early days of the first and second vaccines. Now, in recent months, two Pfizer officials have bragged about moving vaccines science forward at a speed that disallows proper scientific protocols from being followed, and the release of reformulated mRNA COVID boosters without testing is now the norm. In November of 22, recently retired head of vaccine R&D at Pfizer, Katherine Janssen, said, "We flew the aeroplane while we were still building it. We couldn't wait for data. We had to do so much at risk." Pfizer compressed its vaccine development timeline from 10 years to a mere 9 months by simultaneously developing and testing the product in human trials. Pfizer and other COVID jab makers hid side effects by eliminating the control groups long before the studies were over. Vaccine makers are readying to release other mRNA shots, many of which are being fast-tracked and predicted to receive authorization in months rather than years. Moderna is working at a 3-in-1 shot for COVID, flu, and RSV, and they seem to expect releasing it before clinical trials are finished. Pfizer quoted and relied on data from Israel when it sought approval from the FDA, and as it turns out, the Israeli government hid information about side effects. It didn't even implement its surveillance system until a year after the shots rolled out. And when the data were analyzed, researchers concluded there were causative links between certain side effects and the jab. Now, meanwhile, mortality statistics also reveal we've been sold a sack of lies. In the video above, and this is from the McCullough article, he says, nurse instructor John Campbell reviews some of the latest excess deaths as stats, and what he was able to reveal is a weekly excess death in the UK of 1,500 or more people. Unreal. 1,500 extra people dying on top. And if we compare that, the results in New Zealand, the age groups that were most likely to receive a COVID booster had a 7 to 10% more excess deaths than age groups that were ineligible for boosters. Isn't that something else? And to conclude the article from McCullough, when you take off in an unfinished plane, crashing is to be expected because in the real world, you cannot build planes in midair. Likewise, in the real world, you have to do extensive long-term testing starting in animals to be sure a drug is safe. The concept of fast-tracking has been proven a dangerous failure. How long will it take before governments all around the world and industries admit it, particularly here in Australia, where we've set up or setting up an mRNA factory in, of course, Daniel Andrews, Victoria. At TNT Radio, we never go home. We're committed to bringing you our take on the biggest topics of our time. We broadcast live almost 24/7. We have a few repeat shows on Sundays, but other than that, we're live all the time, online globally. No matter what, we've got you covered on TNT Radio.
Keeping you updated on the latest.
In the car while I'm driving home.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen issued a statement on the 30th of November on Russian accountability and the use of Russian frozen assets. Jeremy Beck, one of the news producers on TNT, is here to discuss the issue.
Thanks, Jason. The issue of illegal seizure of Russian state and private assets held abroad has been debated for months by EU officials. However, the European Union's desired mechanism is not easy to apply, as in most EU nations, seizing frozen assets is only legally possible when there is a criminal conviction. Now, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen opened up her formal 30th of November statement saying, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has brought death, devastation, and unspeakable suffering. We all remember the horrors of Bucha. First, Russia must pay for its horrific crimes, including for its crime of aggression against a sovereign state. This is why, while continuing to support the International Criminal Court, we are proposing to set up a specialized court backed up by the United Nations to investigate and prosecute Russia's crime of aggression. And the statement goes on and on. Anyone can read it. It's on the website for the European Commission there. Now, von der Leyen, she said that the damage suffered by Ukraine is estimated at 600 billion euros. She said, we have blocked 300 billion euros of the Russian central bank reserves, and we have frozen 19 billion euros of Russian oligarchs' money. Now, Jason, that 19 billion euros is actually individuals, Russian citizens. She tries to write it off as oligarchs, but the reality is Russian businessmen and women who have money overseas have had their money frozen just because they happen to be Russian. So, of course, Russia says quite rightly that this is basically theft. That's all it is. And I don't know how it's going to go, but it's not a good sign that this letter is really pushing the issue. Jason, who knows where it's going to go? It's looking quite ugly.
Yeah, it certainly is. But in all of this, that the baddies, as it were, are the ones that seem to be setting all these precedents. And we've been saying for some time now that in the great class action that must come at the end of the COVID conspiracy, when it's finally revealed that we all know that it was a scam and the dangers that was caused and no one cared, we get to go after them in this great big class action. And so it is. If they want to go after the Russians, where they really can't do it and freeze assets, etc., well, we'll have no problem being able to do the same, but legally when the time is right. And it's interesting that they're going after private citizens' assets the same way. And so I think that this is perhaps it is all part of All the World as a Stage, and maybe we're just living in the middle of some great theatre in all of this. But realistically, though, the precedents are now being set in all of it. I don't think we need to be too concerned. If they're doing it to us, then, and I say us, I mean the people that aren't following the narrative that's obviously the globalist agenda here and the great cover-up that is the Ukrainian fiasco, that I remember Ross Cameron saying it was nothing more than a money laundering scheme. And here it is. I've never seen so much war being fought about so much money, and it's all the money. Imagine World War II that we ever talked about, oh, well, we've sent this many aeroplanes worth this many millions of dollars to Europe. It just never was spoken of. We never talked of war in terms of money before. We might have talked about it being expensive after the fact, but at the time it was never an issue. And yet it all seems to be about the wealth, which tells me that the wealth that these people have through the FTXs and all the other places may well be drying up. And here we go. Because if you're going after the Russian money to rebuild Ukraine, then you've got no money of your own, have you?
Well, truly, Europe is bankrupt, and the whole Western world is bankrupt in many, many ways, more ways than one, that's for sure. Morally bankrupt too. They're after the money, but it's also about control. It's about vengeance. It's about geopolitics. The geopolitical aspect is enormous, because at the end of the day, this has never, ever been about the Ukrainian people or some sovereign state. What a lot of nonsense. And von der Leyen's reference to Bucha. Now, that is, as far as I'm concerned, and the evidence that I've seen, and I know George Eliason, who's our regular reporter on these issues in Ukraine, and he's basically stated it was a false flag. The Russian officials said it was a false flag operation. It wasn't the Russians who massacred the Ukrainians in Bucha. That's not how it went. And as of battalion, they're the neo-Nazis. They've been all over Ukraine butchering people. Where is the EU Commission carrying on about neo-Nazis? No, you don't see it. Of course you won't. So it's all about politics. It's all about control. And, of course, as you say, this is about money. And if they can grab some money because Europe is bankrupt, well, they'll go after money too.
The only thing that they're not trying to do is make peace, are they? There is no negotiating between Russia, Ukraine. There's the attempts to that we see more so from Russia. But if Europe are that desperate, why wouldn't they be going to the diplomatic table in all of this? Why are they playing such a hard line? For mine, it exposes the fact that this is a fight to the death for all of them. And that's why this money issue seems to be playing out the way that it is. Again, unprecedented in anything we've ever seen in war. It always was negotiated. I don't know why it's different this time, except that it is a battle for planet Earth herself.
Oh, well, I see that there was never any intention for peace. And in fact, the prodding and poking of Russia has been ongoing for many years. The continued expansion of NATO eastwards towards Russia's border. I mean, Russia's made it very clear. Vladimir Putin in his speeches have made it clear that if they have nuclear weapons fired towards Moscow from the far east in NATO countries, they would hit Moscow in about 5 minutes. That doesn't give Russia much time to react. So it's never been about any negotiation. In fact, I don't think that this is new. Consider what happened in World War II. Japan was basically, they're finished. Truman did not have to launch their nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The war was effectively over. America had superiority in the air and sea, naval superiority. Japan was surrounded. They didn't have any natural resources themselves. They could have just let Japan just finish it off. Finish Japan off just quietly. But no, they wanted to use that nuclear bomb to terrify the world. And when I say they, I'm talking about the globalist agenda, which was still around in the 1940s. This is a long-term plan by geopolitical strategists who have wanted an Anglo-American empire, a global elite ruling the entire planet, and they wanted that fear of the nuclear bombs there, that no nation would ever dare, you know, look at this, ever dare challenge this power ever again. Now, of course, we've had a lot of intervening things that have happened in recent decades, but nonetheless, that's been the strategy all along, a strategy of fear, never about peace.
Isn't it shocking that this is where we are, and somehow we have to believe that this is the best that we can possibly do, and therefore it's why we are here right now, and it's part of the reason that we do what we do, Jeremy, in that we can actually provide an alternative viewpoint to the brainwashing that is the Mockingbird media disseminated all around the world. It's terrific that we get to commentate, to be the commentators in this space, to be able to point out the anomalies in all of it. But when you see Europe telling us that they're going to take money from Russia that they can't even take, well, then you know that you're at very close to the end game in all of it. Great reporting, Jeremy. Look forward to speaking with you again tomorrow. After the break, Campbell Newman will be here, former Premier of Queensland, for his analysis and discussion, and we'll try and push the envelope into some new spaces to find out what the establishment may actually be thinking in all of this, and see what we can do to bring upon victory for freedom overall. You're listening to TNT Radio.
Rick Munn on TNT Radio.
Dan Andrews is back for a historic third term as Premier of Victoria. Absolute shocker, or is it? There's a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. There's some celebration that he's back again. People are talking about vote rigging. People are talking about one thing and another. I do believe that the Victorians are suffering from extreme Stockholm syndrome. They have developed an emotional bond with their oppressor slash captor, which is Dan Andrews, over the last 2 to 3 years. They think they're united behind him rather than divided under him. The IPA's John Roscombe says Victorians have 4 more years of suffering after Premier Dan Andrews led Labour to a majority in the state election. So 4 more years of suffering potentially is on the way. Victoria has chosen a Premier who led the state into the biggest debt of any state or territory in the country. And don't forget, locked them down for one of the longest, most oppressive periods in Australian, if not world, history.
Rick Munn is locked and loaded on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Claims that renewables are cheap or will lower prices are proven false. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Campbell Newman is the former Premier of Queensland. He was the 38th Premier, in fact, and he served between March of 2012 and February of 2015. He was the member for Ashgrove in the Legislative Assembly of Queensland. And when he was elected Premier, he won a whopping 78 of 89 seats of that parliament. He also served as the Lord Mayor of Brisbane for around 7 years between March 04 and April 2011. And he joins me now on Jason Q, Citizen and Friends. Welcome back, Campbell.
Hey, Jason. It's great to be with you. And g'day, listeners.
Good on you, Campbell. It's terrific to have you back on the show. I guess the starting point for anything here is your take on the Victorian election. Overall, was it within expectations? What's your take on the whole result so far?
Okay, well, there's a few things to unpack here. The first thing is it didn't surprise me. And, you know, I do point to polls that all, as far as I'm concerned, pointed to a victory by the ALP and Andrews. So there's no surprise there. Why did it happen? Well, there's a few things that are going on. I think the first thing is that the Liberal Party in Victoria have not provided leadership and have not provided a clear alternative. And also during the period of COVID, like a number of the oppositions in other parts of the country, simply fell into line. And I do point out to listeners, Jason, that if you look at the vote, there was actually a very, very high vote for independents and minor parties. Now, some of that did come from the left, and that excludes the Greens, by the way. The Greens, you know, were around, I think, 12 when I last looked. So I think it was quite a high double-digit vote for independents and minor parties, and that, in the main, was splintering from the Liberal Party. And it's because they never would stand up. Their leader wasn't a leader. And indeed, for most of the last few years, I know he was out for a while and then he came back, but he didn't actually prosecute the COVID issues. He didn't prosecute the loss of freedom. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he left his rather more focused and pointed efforts until recent times. And, you know, John Howard, I think, is supposed to have said once that you can't, you know, fatten the pig on market day, and so it is with elections. And so I think, you know, we saw that splintering of the Conservative vote going to people like my own party, the Lib Dems, and other parties of freedom and those independents, and those votes then don't go back easily with preferences. You know, they don't necessarily flow back, and the Liberal Party vote was down very, very in a very marked way. So that's sort of what's going on there. Just one other observation too, and this is perhaps a bit more controversial, but there was an interesting interview between Peter Credlin and one of the former Libs in the state parliament in the last few days. And it's what I would, I don't know that they use this term, but I'd use the donut theory term, and that is that inner city electorates in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane, and we're talking about Melbourne, have gone woke. You've got some of the most well-educated but complacent and wealthy people the country's ever seen. These are people who are worried about climate change as the greatest moral challenge. These are people who think we need to go net zero. These are the ones who didn't suffer during COVID lockdowns because they're the professional class that, you know, they can do their work at their kitchen table or their office, or their study, and they can still earn a productive income. They could be a solicitor. They could be someone who's running a branding and marketing operation. They weren't affected. It was the poor old people in middle and outer suburbs that really copped it. So the Liberal Party's mistake is that they're trying to appeal to people in those inner city areas. So that's the hole in the donut. And I'm afraid they've gone. And that's what the Credlin interview I was referring to really sort of, I think, got to. It's the same in Sydney and it is becoming the same in Brisbane. And so the focus for the Liberal Party or Freedom Parties needs to be in the middle and upper outer suburbs. And then the messaging, the policies, the actual things that you're going to do and say you're going to do in election campaign should be focused to those people. That's what the LNP need to do in Queensland. They need to stop, sort of the fixation with the inner city suburbs and look outwards if they're to have success. And so it will be in the New South Wales state election. So a long-winded answer, Jason, but the trouble with the Liberal Party is they don't get it, and that's why they're losing ground.
Yeah, it's very important that we talk about and be able to find out what is wrong with the Liberal Party if it's going to maintain its pace as the alternate party in office here. If the Liberal Party is leaking votes to the Freedom Movement and the freedom movement isn't able to get enough traction to get people into office, we have a situation that smells and looks like the ALP-DLP split from all those years back, and it seems the only way that this seems to correct itself is through consolidation. And one wonders if the conservative side perhaps it needs to reinvent, because we've got conservative, we've got libertarian, we've got establishment, and we've got very much anti-establishment now, all on one side of the fence. What I'm surprised about is how the anti-establishment movement is not getting on to the left side of the spectrum here. It seems that on that side, people are more than ever willing and able to commit to establishment leftist green woke politics. So when we explore wokeism, and we're probably going to run into the news break and have to rejoin this conversation after it, but a couple of things about it. One, it feels like wokeism is part of what I call the drama triangle in psychology, where you have a victim and you have a rescuer and you have a persecutor. And it is that the person identifies that there's someone that's worse off and they want to go out and rescue. And this seems to be this way of living in the inner city, in the cappuccino latte set, where they used to call them the Chardonnay set. And it's a different world, and people, you know, all doing very well, have six-figure incomes, and they see homeless people living on the street. And of course, they've got to save the world in all of this. And it's the idea that with wokeism, you get credibility by association. So you go along with it, because it seems like the right idea. We've got to protect the earth. We've got to protect this person, that person, the other person. But what we don't do is we don't check against what the government is actually doing. It seems that the government is using it as a confidence trick to sell us into ideas that aren't necessarily for our best interests. And this leads us down a pathway toward control. And it's the control of the people are getting very upset this week around social media on the radio about the digital ID for company directors. They don't want to be in this, and it's been sold as a way to protect against more fraud and other ideas. And business people are as honest as anyone else is saying, well, hang on a second, why do I have to do this? And so again, the left of politics, oh, well, bad luck, they're business people, they rip people off, they'll pay for it, they'll punish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many different stories in all of this.
The digital ID is a great example, as you say. But who brought it in? It was the Morrison government, a supposedly conservative government who weren't. So just the way that – look, let's just talk about that for a sec, because I'm personally been affected by that one. So – What they've done is they've said that every person who wants to be a company director has to have a unique ID. And the reason for that is that there are people who are shonks who have been phoenixing companies and seem to receivership, et cetera, administration, and then sort of walking away from the debts. Well, I say this, the flip side of this, the way to have dealt with it, rather than actually get more state control, would have been for ASIC and the ATO and the regulators, who now have all sorts of information to start properly focusing on people in the community in business who do the wrong thing. And instead of sort of making a rule for everybody to try and catch the bad eggs, and we know they'll be a smaller percentage, let's actually identify the bad eggs, because I'm sure we can find out who they are and we go after them. And rather than impose this new ID thing on everybody, that's what should have happened. You know, it's the same. Look, I'm in financial services, and the compliance that we have to deal with from the Australian Securities Investment Commission is, again, very much designed as one size fits all to go after, you know, it imposes something on everybody rather than actually have a deployment of resources constantly into looking for people who are trying to rip people off. So, you know, the fraudsters are out there all the time. You know, they're advertising, they're promoting product, and if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. I think regulators should focus on that rather than actually always calling for more regulation, because they don't catch the shonks. Well, they might catch a few, but they impose a huge red tape, administrative cost and compliance burden on everybody. And actually, who pays? Well, at the end of the day, society pays.
Well said. We're going to pause for news headlines and a whole lot more after the break. You're on TNT Radio.
We're ready. We're ready. We're ready. News.
The news
is our business, and we never close. Never close.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Western media organisations appear to be backtracking on their stance on Julian Assange and are now campaigning for his freedom. As Elon Musk vows to run a more fair and transparent Twitter that won't interfere in elections, the European Union has threatened to ban the site. And the European Union is looking for a legal loophole which will allow it to sell Russian assets that have been frozen as part of Western sanctions to use the cash to prop up Ukraine.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
If we jump ahead, Campbell, if we all had every company director with their digital ID around the world, do you think it might have stopped the FTX crypto exchange collapse?
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, it wouldn't have because we've got somebody who has, you know, with hindsight, just been so out there and reckless that it could have been identified in the way that I've said. I mean, you know, it screamed. The whole FTX thing screamed for the regulators to go and have a look. You had a guy tender age, you know. I mean, I'm not saying people, you know, that age, around 30, I think, if I recall correctly, can't go and run an effective business. But to be young, to be doing the things that he was doing, and to supposedly be offering the returns that he was, just screams, this needs to be looked at. And all they had to do is go in and ask to see the books and see what he was doing, particularly the magnitude of the enterprise concerned and the immaturity of the crypto sector. It really, look, you know, I work in financial services. There were many of us who raised our eyebrows about some of the things that have been going on in the crypto field in the last few years. So, you know, the regulators were asleep at the wheel. And by the way, I'm really interested to see if this young bloke does get properly investigated. And indeed, it looks, prima facie, it looks like there's a case to be answered. I'm wondering why the regulators actually haven't arrested him so far. It does look that people have really suffered great loss. Well, people have suffered great loss, but what are the regulators doing now? And he does have very significant connections with the left in US politics and has made very, very big election donations to them. And it doesn't look good at all.
No, it certainly doesn't. And when you dig a little deeper and you note the FTT crypto coin that he had, which was pretty much just created out of thin air, and then they were borrowing billions against it, you realise that what they were creating was a form of a Ponzi scheme here. And if that doesn't get the regulators' attention, then nothing will. And we're only reminded, it wasn't very long ago that Bernie Madoff was front and centre with his great big Ponzi scheme that resulted in him being sent away for life. And the journalist who exposed it all, Harry Markopoulos' book on the subject, was called No One Would Listen. And it seems that the regulators don't like to actually step on anyone's toes in all of this. And this is the other problem that I have with it, is why is it when it's the big crime, nothing seems to happen, but it's all the little people that have to make up for punishment here?
I'll give you an Australian example, which I actually be watching very closely, is we've heard a heck of a lot about Star Entertainment and the casinos and the failure to comply with Australian anti-money laundering laws, and you know that's now a matter of the public record that these organisations are, this organisation is in deep trouble. But as yet, Jason, I have not heard one comment in the media about the position of the directors of those that company. Are they going to be held to account? It's not good enough for them to say, you know, we didn't know, or we were, like, they need to be held to account. Are they going to be, are they being investigated? That's what I'd like to know. Is there a case to answer? It's very important, and I certainly don't believe that they should be allowed to just sort of walk away with clean hands. There are people on those boards, on that board, I should say, who departed in more recent times, shall we say, politely, just prior to the really quite damning sort of findings being released. But they were certainly there when the law wasn't complied with. I do sort of agree that there does seem to be a case where if it's a small or medium-sized enterprise, the regulators will come down like a ton of bricks. But if it's large corporates in Australia or the US, they sort of get waved through.
This is this whole mentality of too big to fail. It's something that came out in the GFC of 2008, yep. And it was fairly obvious that these bankers that had been part of the derivative creation that caused the great big collapse and the lending through it was Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae through the subprime lending that was all part of this. Was the basis, yet these bankers are all ending up getting their bonuses with this money that was freshly printed. I mean, as a financier yourself and as someone from public office, what was your reaction back then in 2008 when Obama went down this pathway? When you heard too big to fail, did you shake your head and go, oh, hang on a second, that's a little bit rich? Or was it kind of like, oh, well, let's see what happens?
Well, Jason, I sort of buy the too big to fail in a way, part of it, because what happens is if you do allow these institutions to sort of fall down, you actually take, you know, the little guy down as well. And so I certainly buy an argument that they had to be propped up. However, the way that they were propped up with taxpayers' money, but the taxpayers' bailout didn't come with the right strings attached. We saw it here in Australia. We saw it with, say, JobKeeper, where certain large corporates in this country put out their hand for JobKeeper, didn't, by the way, pay their rent to the owners of the various shopping centres and things that they were in. And, by the way, those things are owned by people's super funds ultimately. You know, so investors always, investment always leads somewhere to someone who's actually in middle Australia. So the point was, with the case of JobKeeper, that they made large profits, didn't pay the rent, and had their hand out for government subsidies. And the government should have been able to claw back during COVID. Go back to the GFC and what you were talking about with the bailouts in the US. The money was paid, taxpayer money, to bail them out, and then they got bonuses, and that's an outrage. So is it naivety from government officials to bail them out, and then they got bonuses, and that's an outrage? So is it naivety from government officials and the politicians? It's been pretty lame. It's been pretty stupid. It could have been foreseen.
Well, the other thing that comes up in all of this is, hang on a second, perhaps they're all working together for a different aim. I mean, if we've only got to fast forward to the COVID age where the big pharma just gets in there and gets a free kick all the way through, approves vaccines that aren't fit for purpose. It seems every day we're learning it's getting worse and worse, injuries everywhere, admissions from Pfizer that they were saying they were building the aeroplane as they were flying it. And we see and of course, the idea that they were given indemnity in all of it. Now, this is about as many free kicks as you can possibly provide to justifying a pandemic. And the same is applying in business in terms of finance again. So we now see that the world is moving into a globalist structure. Governments all around the world are agreeing on the same things in the COVID situation. The World Economic Forum is dictating how things are going to go, the Great Reset in all of this. This is an unelected body that you could never have a global government and have elections ever again. As I keep saying, how do you have an election for a one world government leader that you have in Madagascar and New Zealand and Samoa and Australia all on the same day and expect these votes to be legitimately counted? You're not going to have a leader in all of this. You're not going to have a democracy. It's over. Where do we go from that?
Well, look, there's a fair bit in what you've said there, mate. I guess just in terms of COVID and the vaccine and Pfizer and all that sort of stuff, from my time in the army years ago and then in politics, I tend to view a lot of these things as if it's a choice between a screw up and a conspiracy, it's a screw up every day of the week. I think COVID was a complete stuff up here and overseas. I think the politicians completely lost their proverbial, and effectively they were panicking, and no one in the real positions of leadership ever stopped, stood back, took a deep breath, looked above the melee, if I could put it like that, the thing that was going on, looked to the horizon, looked strategic and said, what is the context in all this and what we're being asked to do? Because it's clear now that the arrangements, the commercial arrangements, the deals that were done on vaccines were inappropriate and wasted money. It's clear now that the whole thing was rushed. But you know what? You didn't have to be blind, Freddie. People like you were saying at the time, people like me were saying it on this and other media outlets. And that's why there does need to be a Royal Commission into COVID in this country. Turning then to the other part of what you said about the World Economic Forum and the reset and all that sort of stuff. Well, look, there's clearly a very influential group of people who are pushing for that. The way that it's really been engineered is that they just they're in charge. There's leaders from around the world. They go to conferences. They mix. They mingle. They rub shoulders with one another. And there's a huge element of groupthink. And we know best. And those little people over there, look, they don't really understand the big picture. So we will sort it out for them. And it's not so much as an organised conspiracy. Again, it's just it's an arrogance. It's hubris. It's we know better. And we're going to set the rules and that sort of stuff. So we all come together in Switzerland, we have our conference, and we all go home, and we then try and implement these same sort of policies. So it sort of happens like that. And I go back to what I was saying about the woke inner city thing in Australia. Just let's take the LNP in Queensland. The trouble with the LNP in Queensland is that they mix and mingle with those people in the inner city. That's where the top surgeons, the top barristers and lawyers, solicitors, that's where the judges, the top architects live. That's where the people who run the advertising companies or the large corporations, they all go to the art gallery, to the Premier's reception or Parliament House for Australia Day for that. There are things going on all the time. They mix, they mingle. They might be political competitors, those between the Labor Party and the Greens and the LNP. The trouble is that's where the groupthink starts, and that's where you go, oh, well, we should have more regulation of a particular issue, and off you go. And that's how our liberties are curtailed in Australia today. And the trouble for people in the LNP is they don't have the guts to stand up and go, look, I'm going to say that this state relies on coal mining and we can't pay the bills, we can't pay for police cars and to have fuel in the tanks or great hospitals and schools, public service that delivers great services and keeps the community sort of operating, ticking over. They don't have the guts to say, well, we need coal to pay for that. You will not find a politician these days in Queensland, I think, in the state parliament who's prepared to stand up and be counted. But it's the truth. And so why are we getting out of coal when people want to buy it and they need it?
Yeah, indeed. Now, we're going to quickly pause for a commercial break. We'll come back and dig a little bit deeper on this subject of mining and also a super profits tax and how that is only going to cause even more problems. You're listening to TNT Radio.
In case you're still wondering why the left is melting down over Elon Musk buying Twitter like a toddler who's been kept in a wet diaper for too long and denied access to the Barbie aisle at Toys R Us, consider his tweet today. The obvious reality, as longtime users know, is that Twitter has failed in trust and safety for a very long time and has interfered in elections. Twitter 2.0 will be far more effective, transparent, and even-handed. Elon has also said that he's going to release reports, internal Twitter reports, on blocking accounts. So we're going to get to see behind the curtain at what went on, what conversations were had when they blocked us. Democrats cannot handle transparency. They cannot survive in a free and open society, which is why they always gravitate towards totalitarianism and censorship. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
I came to clean and noticed there was no food in the house.
She told me her sister just forgot to pay a few bills.
He was in for his monthly trim when I noticed the bruising.
Is there anything I can do?
Thousands of older Australians experience elder abuse every year. If you're concerned about someone you know, you don't need to have all the answers. Call 1-800-ELDER-HELP for free confidential information and support.
TNT.
Alexa, explain BIDEN.
BIDEN is president.
Oh, very good. And now, explain BIDET.
BIDET is your butt washer.
Okay, so they're pretty much the same.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
There's something about the idea of personal responsibility that seems to have been superseded by reliance or dependence on government in all of this. And it goes down to the idea that you're no longer allowed to choose how you're going to deal with your own health. It was the bridge that was first crossed, and it provided for the idea of society to bully those that wouldn't comply. This was a bridge too far. It now moves across now to other forms of compulsory membership, or digital ID, digital director ID, CBDC, crypto, central bank cryptocurrency, and all of it. There is a real pattern forming here that we're moving into, as you said, groupthink, and groupthink becomes hive-mindedness, which is probably the bigger cancer of the little cancer of groupthink and all of it. Does it concern you, Campbell, that we are being pigeonholed in such a way, and that maybe it might well be more than just bad luck, but by design?
I don't think it's by design. But I think it's, again, it is groupthink. And it's definitely happening, though. You know, putting aside your view about it being perhaps coordinated, my view that it's sort of happening as a result just of the interactions of the elite. It really doesn't matter, mate. The point is the risk, the threat to us all is quite real. Mm. And, you know, we actually have to stand against it. We've got to roll it back. We've got to play a part in the political process. If we sit back complacently, we will get what's coming to us, and it is coming to us. And you can see that. I mean, it's interesting. In my workplace, I talk to some of the young guys I work with, or work for me in my business, and I say, just as an example, you know, if we go back, say, about 40 years, just over 40 years ago, the idea of random breath testing, where you pull someone over and got them to blow into a tube, was a very controversial thing. Now, I'm not for a moment suggesting we should go back to the days of people drink driving without any care or responsibility. But that just shows you how far we've moved. Today, everyone would accept, absolutely, that's an appropriate thing to do. Another example is helmets and riding a bicycle and having to wear a helmet. You know, going back 30 years ago, that was not the case in Australia. But today, you'd look strange at someone not wearing a helmet on a bike. Now, I then go and I contrast it to other countries. You know, I was in the UK in July this year. People are not wearing bike helmets. Or when they're riding scooters. People are taking dogs into pubs where you couldn't in Australia. They weren't wearing masks while we still were, you know, curled up a little ball with COVID mania here in Australia. By the way, I've got a very good friend who's an architect who spends a fair bit of time in Vietnam, and he says, I never thought I'd say this, but I feel freer in communist Vietnam than I do in Australia. And we really need to wake up. And what's happened is the mainstream media are just cheerleaders for the continual erosion of our liberties, because whenever they run a story about hard luck, someone's had a bad experience, but they might have been ripped off by a con man, or some business didn't do the right thing by them, or their neighbour gave them a hard time, or they were injured in an accident, it's always a cause for more regulation. And it, my view is it has to stop. I think it's reached an intolerable level in this country. Mm-hmm.
And so the only way out of that is for the people to reject it. There was a story that just came out yesterday that that in the Netherlands, they want to record all transactions over 100 euro and keep this on file for 5 years. Surely to goodness, that has to be a bridge too far.
That is absolutely ridiculous. You know, that's state surveillance and Orwellian.
Yeah.
The principle I always lived by as a politician was, if we're going to bring in a new law, it actually has to be justified. It has to, it actually has to have indisputable, positive net good for the community. Mm. And if our current breed of politicians, who are a bunch of gutless so-and-sos, they really are. I mean, across the aisle, they're cowardly, and they need to start to show some gumption about standing up and questioning things, as I'm saying. Is this going to be of positive net benefit to society? Do we really need to regulate, or should we just accept that maybe people will be inconvenienced or might get hurt if they don't? Here's one that I still question. Did we really need to force people in Australia to put fences around their swimming pools? Mm. I know there were far, far too many tragedies, but really, should we have done that? We carry on at the moment about the cost of housing, but relentlessly, every single year, there are groups of public servants who meet from around the country who continue to up the ante in terms of building regulations. That's fine, but no one what's not fine about it is no one ever questions that every time they add a new regulation, it might be for disability access, it might be for fire safety, it might be for some obscure reason, it might be energy ratings, it adds dollars.
Yes.
So it's this whole thing is completely schizophrenic. On the one hand, we're going, oh, the politicians go, oh dear, the cost of housing. Meanwhile, over here, there's a group of people who, without any control or scrutiny, continue to add cost. I'd have no problem if they were required to say, look, this is what we're now going to do, and it has to be justified in terms of the cost versus the benefits.
Yeah, it's a very good point. We could dig a lot deeper. We're going to run out of time again, Campbell. I want to get your thoughts on the protests in China in all of this. This is something that was possibly unexpected, but certainly set up that something had to happen. You just cannot adopt a COVID zero policy today, lock people in their buildings, physically lock them in, and then have a fire that results in people dying and not expect a protest. But what we're seeing has shades of Tiananmen Square in it, that the youth in China are rebelling, and in a big way. What's your take?
Well, they're so brave, aren't they? When I heard it, I don't know if your listeners will believe me or if you'll believe me, but I literally had, for a moment, I had tears in my eyes because, you know, I remember Tiananmen Square and what happened. And since those days, the security apparatus of the Chinese communist state has become even more effective. I mean, they, I am sure, would be going after anybody who appeared in those protests. They'll do everything they can using facial recognition technology and the surveillance cameras they've deployed to try and track those people down. They will be, and their families will be, subject to threats and coercion about their appearance there. And, you know, and what for? Just exercising their human rights to speak up and say enough's enough, our freedoms are being curtailed more than we can bear. And that's what that's all about.
Now, with 2 minutes to go, I guess the most important question at this point is, what happens with the conservative / freedom / libertarian movement in this country? How does it consolidate and perhaps get some traction ahead of New South Wales next year?
Well, it's like this. I hate to say it, but the Liberal Party have got to listen. The Liberal Party have got to show some leadership, and they really should be reaching out and forming firm relationships with the minor parties and independents. They need to bring people back into the fold, and that means they've got to sort of give some ground, and probably the Freedom Mob have to give some ground as well. And that's me and my colleagues. Yeah. It could be as simple as preferences, but it could be in some ways to try and get people to consolidate. You know, we will continue to see the Labor Party and the Greens ascendant in this country unless we work together. That has to happen. And, you know, the thing that I get concerned about, mate, is I think there are so many on the left in the Liberal Party who point to recent election results, like the federal election and now Victoria, and their narrative on why it's happened is complete rubbish. Like you had Malcolm Turnbull the other day saying the Victorian election was because the Victorian Liberal Party had been captured by the right. You know, for God's sake, they're nowhere near the right. You know, so you can't listen to that rubbish. It's about the things we've talked about already.
Yeah, well said. Well, that was Campbell Newman, former Premier of Queensland, now in the finance business, dedicating some more time with us here on TNT Radio. Campbell, we love having you on the program. Your insights are wonderful, and I look forward to speaking with you before Christmas with all luck. We're going to take news next, and up after that, Darren Denslow and then Tim Price. Thank you, Campbell. You're listening to TNT Radio.